The book is written, of course, during Old Testament times and falls under the Old Testament. Certainly, though, it's a book that has eternal principles. Regardless of any age, regardless of any generation, regardless of any culture, it transcends all of those things. And it paints for us, as we're hoping to see by the end of this lesson, one of the most beautiful pictures of our servant, Jesus Christ. And so if you would, journey with me through this. Is suffering, these are the questions I've been asked to deal with. Is suffering always a sign that the individual sufferer has sinned? Does suffering always have an evil purpose attached to it? Is suffering always the direct result of punishment from God? No doubt we could answer that very simply with a very single word answer. Many of the speakers before have touched on this. As a matter of fact, I was messing with Brother Metter and Brother Cates earlier about how they pretty much said everything last night that I intend to say this morning. So I could just, you know, punch play if the tollers would let us and you would get to hear that again. But you're stuck with listening to me for this hour. Book of James, Job, causes us to question, if you will, our own suffering. No doubt during times of great crisis, during times of great chaos, we will look at our own life and say, did I bring this upon myself? Is this my fault? Is this something that I caused? What have I done in order to receive this kind of treatment? Life's not fair, we often say. Why me? We shout. Well, the book of Job teaches us that there's more to suffering than personal blame. It comes from the patriarchal view of God. That suffering is self-imposed. God is a punisher. Those who receive great material goods and great material wealth are being blessed by God. That's one of the reasons why whenever you look at the story of the rich young ruler, he says, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Well, you do this and do that and do that. I've done those things since I was a child. God looked at him. Jesus looked at him and loved him. Realizing that this man, this rich young ruler, was still very lost because he had put his material wealth in front of God. And the question is asked, who then can be saved? If the rich cannot be saved, who can be saved? Because see, God has blessed them, but not the poor, not the blind, not the beggar. Well, suffering is self-imposed. If it were the case that only rapists and murderers, for example's sake, received suffering in this life, then we could step back and say, oh yeah, God punishes those who are wicked. We look at the Bible, we understand that murder, that these things are wrong. Therefore, of course, they're going to receive some punishment. But what you have instead is the young child who suffers pain for no cause of their own. The mother, the father, your friends, who for some reason has some unexplained ailment that doctors can't figure out. They just don't know. And these are good people. The question of suffering is no doubt the strongest of all atheistic arguments. If God is all powerful, if God is all good, if God is all loving, then why does He let things like this happen? What kind of a loving God would allow Job to go through the things that he went through? Well, we'll find out exactly what kind of loving God we have. Most try to escape pain. We see that more and more books are being written about suffering and about the cause and about how to live through it, how to work through it. More and more prescription drugs are prescribed or made up, chemicalized every single day so that we can escape more and more from the pain which is so common to mankind. Give me whatever you can give me to make me not feel the pain. Consider the set and setting, if you will, of Job. And we have been through this, but in order to get where I am going in my lesson, we'll have to cover some of this again. God and Satan come to some kind of terms together, some kind of an agreement. Satan says, you've put this hedge around Job. He's not going to deny you. He's not going to stop worshiping you, because as long as he's righteous, as long as he's faithful, you're going to continue to give him good things. And as long as you're giving him good things, he's going to continue to be righteous. God says, no, you haven't really considered my servant Job. So the sons of God came to present themselves, Job chapter 1 verse 6, before the Lord. How this scenario is happening, why, I have no idea. I don't care. All I know is that the principles are taught right here. God and Satan come to this agreement. God says, where have you been? In verse 7, and Satan says, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it. We're going to come back to that in just a moment, so I want you to remember that that's one of the notes that Job makes. That Satan makes. God allows Satan then to touch Job, if you will, and to bring affliction upon his life. Natural means are used, and it's very important to notice that now. Natural means are used. The Sabaeans come, lightning strikes, the Chaldeans come, tornadoes come, and all of those physical elements are going to be used by these arguers of Job in just a moment. And so all of these physical elements happen. His family, his wealth, his prosperity is all taken away from him in a moment. And just that alone is enough to bring most people to denial of God. If this is happening to me, then there must not be a God. One thing that we find from Job is that while he questioned God, he never denied God's existence, nor did he ever deny God's hand in this. He just didn't understand why. He understood the spiritual implications, though, that it came from God from the very beginning. Well, so God uses these natural means. In Job chapter 2, we have the same scenario, if you will. Satan approaches God again. Where do you come from? Verse 2. From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. What is he doing here? What is Satan doing walking down and up and down the earth here? He's looking for somebody to inflict some kind of pain on. He's looking for some kind of target. Our devil, the adversary. He's not a friend. He's not looking to help. It's a very present evil that's walking up and down upon the earth. And something that's very important from the very beginning of this lesson, even though we're a few minutes into it, is chapter 2 and verse 3. God says he still holds fast his integrity, although you incite me against him to destroy him without reason. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not a theological purpose here, but what it does mean is that Job has caused nothing himself in order to require this affliction to come upon him. He's innocent. God declares this from the very beginning. You've asked me to punish him without cause, and I believe that Brother Cates made a very good point last night whenever he says, well, if God had said, no, I'm not going to let you do that, then Satan would have simply said, well, you see, he would deny you, wouldn't he? He doesn't have as much faith as you think he does. So God allows this to happen without it being any blame or any fault of Job whatsoever. So, as would be natural, I suppose, Job begins to lament. Well, before that, his friends come. His friends come. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, probably people that knew him for some time, that were elite in their community. They come to comfort Job. They sit there silently for 7 days and 7 nights. It was typical for the mourner to be the first one to speak rather than the others. Of course, we kind of toss that around in society today. We see somebody mourning, we go up to them and say, it's okay, it was God's will. And, you know, sometimes those words are not very encouraging, are they? Especially in light of some of the things that we find in the book of Job. Well, so Job begins to lament. First of all, he laments his conception, chapter 3, verse 3. He laments the fact that he did not die when he was born. You see, if he had died when he was born, then he wouldn't have to grow to this state of affliction. Job chapter 3 and verse 11. Then in Job chapter 3 verse 16, he says, why didn't I just die in the womb? Why wasn't I just miscarried? Job chapter 3 and verse 16. Well, Eliphaz, the first three of Job's friend, begins to speak. After that, Bildad will come in. After that, Zophar. Eliphaz is going to, let me just jump over to Bildad and come back in a moment to Eliphaz. Bildad's going to say, you're suffering for your children's sake in Job 8 verse 4. And Zophar is going to say, you deserve more than what God has given to you in Job chapter 11 and verse 6. Eliphaz says, listen, Job, the innocent do not perish. Therefore, I encourage you to not despise the almighty hand of the discipline of God, but rather to simply be patient. Now, after reading through this, I feel that one of the things that Eliphaz is trying to do here is truly encourage Job in some way. Now, he's going to start out by these encouraging words. By the end of his speech, he's actually going to begin to use implication, if you will, to blame Job for his own suffering. Well, Eliphaz probably also is the superior sage of these three. His name is mentioned first in Job chapter 2, where the friends are coming. His name is the first one that's mentioned. He is the first speaker in the series of speeches. And if you were to turn over to Job chapter 42, we find when God rebukes Job and his friends, God rebukes Job's friends, it says, and afterward the Lord spoke to these words to Job. The Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends. Chances are Eliphaz was the one here who should have been the strongest character, the most prominent figure in these stories. He begins speaking first, and the words that he utters proves that he has no spiritual insight, no acknowledgement of the divine nature of this suffering whatsoever. He looks at these physical elements, the Chaldeans, the Sabaeans, the lightning, the tornado, and he begins to rationalize the unexplainable things of God. He begins to think and he begins to try to answer for God. Well, they were all wrong. Let's look at this. Job chapter 4. He begins by encouraging Job, if you will. He introduces his speech in verses 4, chapter 4, verses 1 through 6. And he says in verses 1 and 2, Job, who can keep silent any longer? We've listened to you. We've sat here. We've watched. No doubt Job has been suffering for months, as we find in Job chapter 7. This is not just 7 days that he's been sitting there. Job, we can no longer keep silent. He says, you have done wonderful things. Look how he's encouraging Job here to remember the past that he's offered help. To look at how he's extended his hand to those who were suffering. He says, you've upheld the weak. You've strengthened the feeble knees. You've encouraged those who were stumbling. Now it comes to you, he says, and you don't practice what you preach, do you? You encourage other people when they're suffering, and you encourage other people when they're in affliction. But now you yourself come to this state and you're impatient. And he asks the question, remember, Job, whoever perished that was innocent? Before that question, though, look in verse 6. After saying all that I just said, he says, is not your fear of God? Is not your righteousness? Is not the way that you conduct your life and walk in the image of man according to... Is not that your righteousness, what you should rely upon? We find the self-righteous Pharisees in the first century relying upon their own self-righteousness to receive the rewards of God. And we find here Eliphaz encouraging Job in the same. Job, rely upon your righteousness. Remember, who was ever innocent that perished? He asks three questions, this being the first of these three. First of all, let us remember that he begins with human logic and reasoning. He is not here considering or concerned about the spiritual. We've got to keep in mind that from the very beginning, God said this is happening without cause. So we can automatically write off pretty much everything that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar has to say about God and what their thought about God is. So Eliphaz says, first of all, who was ever innocent that perished? Or where were the righteous cut off? No doubt he had heard the story about Cain. He had forgotten history, probably had forgotten the future also, or not considered that there would come one who would suffer unrighteously and unjustly for the cause of everyone else. That is Jesus Christ. Well, look, we can continue in the same passage, understanding that this is all from the mind and thought, trying to find some rationale, trying to find some answer that Eliphaz has. Verse 8, as I have seen... Yet what we know is that Eliphaz, again, had no spiritual insight in this regard whatsoever. He failed to acknowledge the spiritual element that God had planned for Job from the very beginning. He's an ignorant man and ignorant of God's wisdom at this point. He asks a second question in verse 17. Can a mortal man be right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? Now in this he's implying, no, man can't be pure before God. Man cannot be pure before his maker. We know though from prior lessons that we had and also lessons that will come from this lesson in just a little while, that God does hear man. God does want a relationship with him. Eliphaz acknowledges only one side of God. This is as the atheist who looks at a fossil and makes the argument and says, this must be however many years old, and it must be from this time period. And the atheist looks at it biasly and says, God could not have created this because I don't believe in God. Therefore, this must be true. This is kind of what Eliphaz is doing here. He's looking at God only from his own perspective, from his own understanding, from his own desires, from his own will, from his own human reasoning and logic, not acknowledging God's wisdom and plan in this. And yet over and over again, his arguments are proven to be fallacious. This word, he says, verse 12, was brought to me stealthily. Now, I can't get into it too much because I'm going to be getting into it again. There's a lot coming at the end. I hope I make it to the end. In Job chapter 32, Elihu begins to make arguments against Job and against the friends. And he says that there are a couple of ways that God speaks to man. One of the ways, he said, was through visions or dreams. We know that the Bible teaches in Deuteronomy that if a man is a prophet and has a vision or dream and talks about it and it comes true, then you can acknowledge that person as righteous, as real, as authentic, as genuine. What we see here, though, is Eliphaz, where he got it, what kind of dream he had, I have no idea. But I know that this was not God revealing information to him through the dream, but his own desire, his own projections of what he thinks Job needs to do according to how he feels God is. And we find him to be wrong. That doesn't mean that he could not have been right if he had been spiritual in this regard. Does not mean that God could not have revealed to him in a dream. But according to what he says, and according to what we know the book of Job to say, he was wrong. So he asks the question, is there anyone who will... verse 17. Can a mortal man be right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? Well, we know that God seeks a relationship with man. We know that that's true because when there was no relationship, he sent his son down in bodily form to walk and to live and to serve as a man, but also to show us that there was something greater than this physical world. Something superior. Something beyond. Well, question 3. Verse chapter 5 and verse 1. Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? He says. Here's where he really begins, really accuses Job, I feel, and more in a roundabout sort of way. He says in verse 3, I've seen the fool taken down. Or, you know, I've seen the fool taking root, he says. But then suddenly, cursed. Suddenly collapses. Suddenly his riches, his wealth, his prosperity, it's all gone. Now, I think it's interesting to note at this point that Eliphaz was certainly a man who noticed whenever the prosperity the prosperous collapsed, whenever those who were rich and wealthy and wonderful, whenever they collapsed, I wonder how often he noticed those who never had an opportunity to collapse. Those who were born blind, those who were born beggars, those who were poor, born in affliction. Certainly a materialistic, materially minded man. He ignorantly again accuses Job, verse 6, for affliction does not come out of the dust. As a weed grows on its own, as was mentioned the other day, that's not how affliction is, he says. You've done this to yourself, Job. This is your fault. Now we know that sometimes people do bring pain and affliction upon themselves. Sometimes it's caused by other people. Here we find that there was no cause from Job. He did nothing. Job did nothing to deserve this kind of treatment. Life was not fair to Job. Life is not fair sometimes to any of us. We were never promised that it would be fair. We were promised, though, that all things would be meted out in the end. That all things would be made right. That God's justice would be served. That He would take vengeance on those who persecuted or afflicted the righteous. He would give us that rest. In Job chapter 5 and verse 8, Eliphaz makes a judgment. Judge not that you be not judged. Well, this is what Eliphaz does here. Job, if I were you. How many times somebody said that to you? If I were you, this is what I would do. Get yourself in that situation. Sit down there on the ground for months and months and months with worms crawling in and out of your skin. Pus oozing out of your body. Your bones sticking out of your fingertips. Your mind, your body, your spirit, everything in so much pain. We don't know pain like Job experienced pain. We have no idea. We think because we get a flat tire on the way to work on, you know, Monday morning, that that's a bad day. Why me? No, that's not pain. That's not suffering. If I were you, he has no idea what he would do. And proves himself to be ignorant of spiritual things by his own testimony. He tries to rationalize and explain the unexplainable things of God. As oftentimes we try to do even today. And sometimes it's just not possible. Well, Eliphaz concludes chapter and even gives what I believe to be some insight here. In Job chapter 5, verse 17, he says, blessed is the one whom God reproves. And I believe that it was Brother Brumback Sunday morning that made the statement that he could consider the righteousness of him who was sending the affliction and then the end that that righteous sender intended for him. That is, that Job, the creation, could consider that God, the Creator, has some wisdom, some insight, some foreknowledge about this information that I don't have. So there is some insight here that Eliphaz offers. Bless God. Blesses the one that God reproves. Therefore, do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. He also says in chapter 5, verses 18 and 19, God will heal you. I don't know if this is prophetic. I guess he's, you know, indicating that physically, at the end of all of this, God would take care of him, which would make sense if Job initially was being encouraged by Eliphaz. If Eliphaz came and said, Job, I know, listen, the righteous do not perish. You are a righteous person. I've seen the good that you've done. I know the good that's going to come from this. I know God is going to bless you in the end. You just hang in there, Job. Yet he's still accusing Job of it being his fault. Well, he also says in verses 25 through 26 that he would have many offspring and a long life. But what's really funny is at the end of his speech, at the end of his speech of ignorance, if you will, because he had no idea here about God and the spiritual element of this, he says this, "Behold, we have searched out, it is true, hear and know it for your good." And we wonder why sometimes people question the wisdom or authority of others. Job had every right to question the wisdom and the authority of Eliphaz because Eliphaz was wrong. Well, the conclusion of his of that, so to speak, the innocent do perish. Jesus Christ did. Mortal man can be right before God. Jesus Christ died so that we could be. There is one who will answer. We have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ. We can go to God on our own behalf, on the behalf of others, and He has promised to hear us. Well, that really doesn't answer, though, why suffering exists, or why those who are not evil suffer as well. Well, Elihu, turn with me to Job chapter 32. Elihu answers the question in this book, why suffering exists. Starts out in Job chapter 32 saying that he's angry. He says, "I'm angry with you, Job, because you seek to justify yourself. Oh, poor me. Why me? What did I do? This isn't fair." Rather than trying to seek out God's wisdom, you justify your, "I didn't do anything wrong. This isn't my fault." And he says that he's angry at Job's friends. Because while they declared unto him, they all had something to say. Eliphaz, Zophar, Bildad all had words of wisdom to give to Job during his times of crisis. All of them were wrong. They had no answer. They judged Job even though they could find no reason. They judged him as wrong. "Well, Job, you're right. We can't see anything that you've done, but you're wrong anyway. That's the only answer that we're going to give you." Well, you can imagine how Elihu would be angry about this. Anybody who's read the book of Job would be angry about the fact that Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar were ignorant of God's will and God's way. They sought their own. So Elihu makes a few points, beginning in chapter 32, verses 7 and following. Beginning in verse 7, he says, "Let days speak and many years teach wisdom. But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty that makes him understand. It is not the old who are wise, nor the aged who understand what's right." He says, "Now I've sat and listened to your words of wisdom. Now I've been patient. Now you're going to hear me. I'm going to speak now." I think it's wise on Elihu's part as a young man to wait until these who are older and wiser and more recognized give their view. But when the view's wrong, age doesn't matter. It's got to be taught what is true, what is right. So he says, "Age doesn't make wise. Listen to me." Verse 11, he says, "I sat and I waited. Behold, I waited for your words. I listened for your wise saying, while you searched out what to say, while you thought about it, while you tried to rationalize God, while you tried to find reasoning for all of this, when God has already said there is no reasoning." Young Elihu says, "I sat and listened while you tried to find an answer, while you searched through all of the typical responses." Verse 14, latter part, "I will not answer him with your speeches." I'm not going to use the same logic that you've used, the same rationale and same reasoning that you have uttered. He says, "Like new wineskins, I'm ready to explode." Verses 18 and 19. "The Spirit compels me. I cannot keep silent. I must answer." And he says in verse 22, "I don't know how to flatter. So we're just going to talk about this." He says in chapter 33, "Job, you and I are made of clay. We're just both clay pots. We're both just humans here. We're going to talk back and forth, and you don't have any reason to fear me, but I want to talk to you. I'm going to ask you some questions now. Elihu, in chapter 33, verses 9 through 14, verses 9 through 11, quote Job's declaration of innocence. And part of what he says is that, Job, you said, there's nobody, God's not going to hear me, God won't listen to me, where is he? And he says in verses 12 and 13, Job, you're wrong, but in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words? For God speaks in one way and in two, though a man does not perceive it. Here's where Elihu answers the argument why people suffer. He says God speaks to man and is trying to speak to man. And he does it in two ways. One, we find in verse 15, in dreams and visions of the night. He says in verse 16, then he opens the ears of men and terrifies them with warnings. Now, apparently Eliphaz thought he had one of these visions or dreams, but he was wrong. He did not. He also says, though, that these visions, these dreams, are in order to turn a man away from his deed. Well, he doesn't stop, though. He gives the second reason in Job chapter 33 and verse 19. He says, man is also rebuked with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones. He says in verse 20, he doesn't have an appetite. He says in verse 21, he's weak, he's frail. He says in verse 22, he longs for death. And if you've ever experienced a great amount of suffering and pain, you may have just sat there and contemplated how much better off death would be than life. Paul said it, for me to live is Christ, but how much better off I would be if I were dead. To die is gain. He longs for death, verse 22. But, verse 23, if there be for him an angel or a mediator, one of a thousand, what is he saying here? If there's any kind of a spiritual part of this man, then that suffering will cause him to lose his mind, if you will, to get out of his body, to kneel down on his knees and pray to Almighty God. Verse 26 says it calls him to that. And when you've lost your health, when you've lost your wealth, when you've lost your family, and you're laying down on the ground, you can't eat, you can't sleep, you can't see, you can't talk, you can't do anything, and the only thing you have left in you is your breath. Then you acknowledge God. Man is scared to death of death and pain. Let me close with this. God comes in here at the end of this picture and paints a beautiful portrait of himself. And he says, Job, I'm going to question you now. Consider the behemoth. This masterful creation that I created just like I created you. Who is going to go near him? Who is going to go near him? But God, who created the behemoth, that you won't approach. You're not going to go near the behemoth, but I am approachable. We know that God is approachable. He brings up the example of the Leviathan in verse chapter 41 and verse 1. Can you draw out the Leviathan with a fish hook? Can you bind him? Can you tie him down, Job? Can you capture him? Will he make many pleas with you? Verse 3. Will he speak soft words to you? Verse 3. Will he make a covenant with you? Verse 4. Will he take you to be his servant? Will you take him to be your servant forever? All of the answers are there by implication. It's rhetorical questions, aren't it? But I, Job, and he doesn't say this, but you can certainly see God here. I, who created the behemoth, who created the Leviathan, I am approachable. I do make pleas with you. I do speak kind words with you. I do make a covenant with you. I promise to be your servant forever. And that's given to us in the body of Jesus Christ, our Lord, our God, our servant. John chapter 3 bears that out as well. We have the image here of a wonderful God who created a wonderful person. He makes pleas with us. He kindly speaks to us. He makes a covenant with us. He offers himself as a servant for us. So that during times of suffering, during times of trials that are unexplainable, no matter what kind of human rationale or reasoning or logic you try to dream up, we can know that we have a Father who loves us and who hurts with us. God can see the end before the beginning. He knows how things are going to turn out. We just have to learn to trust, believe, and have faith in Him. Not faith in our righteousness, but faith in the righteousness of God. Thank you very much.